Today is Wednesday, the 16th of April. This is Kathy bringing you the Herald and Review for today. Top headline from the paper today under public service. For Jones, time is up. Parking monitor retires after 26 years by Danette Beckett. As a young adult, Shelley Jones was envious of the meter maids, even after she received a few parking tickets herself. "I thought those ladies picked on me and always looked for my car," she said, "but I always thought their job would be fun." After she began her job as a parking enforcement officer, previously referred to as a meter maid, Jones, now 62, quickly learned no one was looking out for her or her car. "It was never like that," she said. Jones retired after 38 years working for the Decatur Police Department, 26 years as a parking enforcement officer, the job she coveted in her early 20s. She began her career with the city as a typist in the investigations division. She doesn't regret her move to the parking meters. "When you work downtown for so long, the people that you give the tickets to, they become your friends. Kind of," she said. "I've done it so long, they realize I'm just doing my job." Parking enforcement officers often bring bad news to the vehicle owners violating parking restrictions, so threats can be a part of the routines, Jones said. "One guy was going to hit me," she said, "but one time I booted a guy's car, and he asked if he could have a photo with me. Nobody ever asked for that." The police department has two parking enforcement officers on staff. "At one time there were five of us," Jones said. Lieutenant John Quayle is their supervisor. They go throughout the city and deal with handicapped parking violations, abandoned vehicles, and other parking complaints, he said. "That way we don't tie up officers doing that kind of stuff." Quayle relied on Jones to help train the officer who took her place. "We hired someone just so Shelley could take the time to train that new person," he said. "We'll miss her experience and her knowledge." Downtown Decatur has changed since Jones began her career. With meter maids on patrol, shopping used to end at 8:30 p.m., including on Saturdays. More than 10 years ago, the meters were removed in select areas to test free parking. Most of downtown remains meter-free. However, the officers still enforce areas with signs posting time limits. Jones says she prefers the meters. "Nobody wants to put money in the meter, but now when you go downtown for lunch, you have a harder time trying to find a place to park," she said. "It's all employees coming out playing the move your car game." During the time when meter parking was enforced, the employees usually parked further away from the shops and free lots, Jones remembered. "I think the city also made a lot more money when we had the meter," she said. Now the parking enforcement officers use vehicles equipped with multiple cameras. The camera captures the images of the vehicles and tires as well as the surroundings. "It's like taking about 12 or 15 photos of every vehicle," Jones said. The photos from 2 hours ago are compared with the most recent photos, and that's how you write up a ticket now, she said. Jones appreciated the job and the people she met along the way. "It's a thankless job, but you get to meet a lot of people," she said, "and I like being outside. It's not perfect in the winter time when you're walking and have to get a little broom to knock off all the snow from the meters just to be able to see them." Homeschool bill stalls in Illinois House, but sponsor says it's still alive. And this is from the Capital News, Illinois. A bill that would tighten homeschooling regulations in Illinois missed a key deadline last week, but its sponsor, Representative Tara Costa Howard, said it's still alive and she's working on changes recommended by fellow lawmakers to get it passed. "We recognize that there's some more changes that need to be made and we want to be respectful of the process," Costa Howard, Democrat of Glen Ellyn, told Capital News Illinois. "I want to pass a bill that we can be proud of. And even though I'm proud of the bill now, I want to be able to take into consideration some other suggestions that have been made." The proposal, amended twice in recent weeks, would require parents to file a declaration of intent with the Regional Office of Education. If a truancy investigation arises, officers could ask for schoolwork or lesson plans. Costa Howard introduced the bill after a Capital News Illinois and ProPublica investigation last summer revealed Illinois' lack of oversight in cases where children weren't receiving an education. Illinois has some of the loosest homeschooling laws in the country, and multiple truancy officers told reporters that when they investigated a truancy case and the parents claimed they were homeschooling, the investigation came to a grinding halt, even if concerns remained. In the worst cases, children disappeared from school and endured abuse or neglect at home for years before the authorities became aware. The bill has become one of the most divisive issues in the Capitol this session, drawing thousands of opponents led by two Christian homeschooling organizations, Illinois Christian Home Educators and the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. On Thursday, Will Estrada, in an upbeat message on the Homeschool Legal Defense Association's Facebook page, shared news that the bill's sponsors did not have the votes currently on the floor to move the bill. The organization's chief legal counsel called it hard to overstate how significant this news is. Estrada congratulated homeschooling families for their efforts, adding, "The good news is your phone calls, your efforts, your talking to your friends, you're continuing to get the word out to the legislators in Springfield, your voices are being heard." However, Estrada cautioned that the stall doesn't mean the battle is over. On Saturday, Estrada joined Illinois Christian Home Educators Executive Director Kirk Smith in a Facebook video message from a homeschooling conference in Peoria. They urged their followers to tone down their efforts during the legislative break that coincides with Passover and Easter. "We have kind of a change of strategy," Estrada said. "We want to limit the activity politically this week," Smith added. "We encourage those who may have friends who are representatives to reach out to them lovingly during this time, but let's give the legislature a little time to catch their breath." Though both organizations have stressed their members to communicate their opposition politely with lawmakers, Costa Howard said these organizations have stoked fear, amplifying fringe voices. Since introducing the bill, Costa Howard said she's been inundated with hostile calls and emails, including a letter she perceived as a death threat. The anonymous letter addressed to Costa Howard at her legislative office in Lombard referenced House Bill 2827, the Homeschool Act, and contained five lines. "It's all over the country, we all know. It starts here and must end here. If we have to break the sixth commandments, so be it. God said, do not kill, but also said, smite thine enemy. We're watching." Costa Howard turned the letter over to police, who says they are investigating it in her home district. The bill has also drawn opposition from minority communities. Pastor Chris Butler testified against the bill last week when the amended version came before the House Education Policy Committee. "I'm here today as somebody who grew up in Chicago public schools," Butler said. "I'm here today sitting next to someone who taught in Chicago's public schools, and we too have grown up, and we too have something to say about the education that we received. And that is why people in our generation have stepped up and said we must do something different." He argued that any regulation would impede minority families from homeschooling to escape failing public schools and encouraged opponents to continue filing witness slips opposing the bill and speaking out against it. Editorial boards at the Chicago Tribune and the Wall Street Journal have also opposed the bill. The Tribune said the bill overreaches, while the Journal raised privacy concerns about the information that homeschool families could be required to provide on the forms. The anonymous letter to Costa Howard was postmarked from a mail distribution site in Kearney, New Jersey on March 24th, 3 days after the editorial appeared in the Wall Street Journal. The return address was listed simply as The Rancher, East Coast. Under Illinois law, threatening a public official is a Class 3 felony. The Lombard Police Department declined to comment but did provide, under a Freedom of Information Act request, a copy of the report that contained the typewritten, unsigned letter. Costa Howard also alerted the Illinois State Police regarding the letter. An ISP spokesman said the agency assesses potential threats and determines needed actions based on the findings of the assessment, which may include further consultation, and, if necessary, makes recommendations to enhance security. Despite vitriolic communication, Costa Howard said she is pressing forward because of those who've also reached out to say they were victims of inadequate homeschooling and want more protections in the law. The bill missed a procedural deadline on Friday for non-budget bills to clear the chamber of origin, but lawmakers can request an extension, which Costa Howard has done. "The one thing I've learned about Springfield is don't ever count something out," she said. Representative Amy Ellick, Republican of Alton, disagreed. "This bill was doomed from the beginning," Ellick said from the House floor Friday, after Costa Howard made a brief speech about the bill. Costa Howard says changes to the bill have already been made to address concerns that she's working on more. The amendment that passed the House committee on April 9th provided more specific details for the declaration form, ensured that an online version would be available, and clarified that a truancy investigation would be required to compel families to turn over homeschooling portfolios. Another change addresses concerns from private schools, which had opposed having to provide a list of students to the Illinois State Board of Education. Under the change, private schools would only need to verify a student's attendance record if asked in a truancy investigation. Costa Howard said she remains open to negotiations on the bill's finer details, but believes passing new safeguards is critical to protect children from parents who claim they're homeschooling but don't follow through. "I do not back down from bullies," Costa Howard said, "and there are victims that have reached out to me consistently thanking me because it has allowed them to raise their voices and feel they could speak about the experiences that they have had as well." And this next headline, Trump's trade war. Democrats dislike the chaos of Trump's trade war but are okay with some tariffs. And this is from the Associated Press. Democrats are quick to say President Donald Trump's tariffs are horrible, awful, terrible. But Democrats also stress that they are not inherently anti-tariff. What Trump's political opponents say they really dislike is the chaos he unleashed. "Tariffs are an important tool in our economic toolbox," said Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts. "Trump is creating chaos, and that chaos undercuts our economy and our families, both in the short term and the long term. He's just created a worldwide hurricane, and that's not good for anyone." Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, said that Democrats have a consensus around a unified concept, which is targeted tariffs can work. Across-the-board tariffs are bad. "The right targeting is in the eye of the beholder, but nobody on our side thinks zero tariffs ever," Kaine said. The Democrats' message is meant to convey that they are reasonable, focused on capable governance, and attuned to financial market distress. It's a pitch toward swing voters who would like to see more manufacturing that are uncomfortable with the consequences of Trump's approach to tariffs. The risk that it is a nuanced argument at a time when pithy critiques travel faster and spread wider on social media than do measured policy analysis. To the Trump White House, the message is nothing but hypocrisy. White House Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt noted last Tuesday that Representative Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California, warned in June 1996 that trade with China meant higher trade deficits and job losses. "It's about nothing less than our economic future, our national security, and our democratic principles," Pelosi said, before the House voted to not overturn then-Democrat President Bill Clinton's decision to extend most favored nation trade status for China for another year. The Trump administration views these remarks as evidence that Democrats actually back what Trump is doing despite their stated opposition. "Everyone in Washington, whether they want to admit it or not, knows that this president is right when it comes to tariffs and when it comes to trade," Leavitt told reporters. Nancy Pelosi can thank President Trump today. Not all Democrats threaded the needle cleanly. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer gave a speech Wednesday in Washington calling for tariffs to be used like a scalpel. Hours later, she was in the Oval Office with Trump in a moment caught on video as the president signed directives for the Justice Department to investigate two of his public critics and gave noncommittal musings on tariff negotiations. Whitman's office later said she was surprised that she was brought in for the event after meeting with Trump, and her presence is not an endorsement of the actions taken or the statements made at that event. Trump this month unilaterally imposed sweeping tariffs on China, the European Union, Mexico, Canada, Japan, and South Korea, among dozens of other nations. On Wednesday, he suspended most of the tariffs for 90 days while applying a baseline import tax of 10% to most nations, 145% tariff on Chinese goods, and a tariff of as much as 25% on Mexico and Canada. There are also tariffs on auto, steel, and aluminum, with more planned on specific products. The tariffs are expected to generate hundreds of billions of dollars annually in new revenues, but an average U.S. household could see disposable income fall by more than $4,000 as importers and companies pass along the costs of the levies. Interest rates on the U.S. debt are rising as investors worry about the soundness of Trump's policies. Major stock indexes are down, and consumer sentiment is at its second lowest level in the history of the University of Michigan survey. Some Democrats are trying to keep the focus on their constituents, resurrecting talking points from Trump's tariff battles during his first term. Farmers in particular, who were hit very hard by Trump's last trade wars, are terrified that this may be existential to their businesses, said Senator Tammy Baldwin, Democrat of Wisconsin. These are mostly small and medium-sized family farms. Their input costs are going to go up and their export markets are going to close down. Representative Gwen Moore, Democrat of Wisconsin, said the tariffs would be catastrophic for urban and rural communities alike in her state. But Moore added that Democrats should advocate for raising labor and product standards to keep American goods and services competitive in global markets. I know that many of our auto workers were lured into voting for Donald Trump because they thought perhaps he was going to give them some relief, Moore said. But the prices of cars are going to go up because the component parts are everywhere. There's no strategy for it. Not all Democrats want to hedge their response to Trump's trade tools. I'm a little uninterested in what the Democratic response should be like, said Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii. Trump is intentionally destroying the American economy, and I think we should just say that it did not make it very complicated. Under agribusiness, the headline reads, Midwest Farms Seek Good Help, by Benjamin Harold from the Illinois Farmer Today. There are only so many hours in a day and plenty of work to be done on a farm. Meeting those labor needs has been a challenge for farming operations as farm workforce ages and fewer people experience a direct connection to agriculture. The industry finds itself in competition with others in a tight labor market, said Ryan Milholland, agribusiness professor at the University of Missouri Extension. The ag workforce, the labor available, is aging, he said. It's pushing on farms hard. It's also pushing up what we're spending on labor. The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects that overall employment of U.S. agricultural workers will decline 2% from 2023 to 2033. At the same time, the Federal Bureau estimated that an average of 116,400 agricultural jobs would open up each year over that decade as a result of workers retiring or changing careers. Median pay for agricultural workers as of 2023 was $34,790 per year, or $16.73 an hour, according to the Bureau. Adding to the challenge of the demographics of the country overall, and rural areas in particular, said Mark White, program leader for the University of Illinois Extension's Community and Economic Development Program. As a country, we're aging, he said, adding, one of the reasons it's so hard to find work is that there are fewer workers to find. White said the baby boomer generation is largely retired, and the millennial generation is fully into the workforce already. So there's not much growth in that group. Generation Z comes next, and it is a smaller group. Also, workforce participation has continued to lag behind pre-COVID levels, he said. In addition to those trends, a relatively small percent of the population has direct experience with agriculture, so it can be tougher to get people to consider that sector for work. In agriculture, there's a challenge to finding people who want to do those jobs, White said. Part of that is fewer and fewer people are exposed to agricultural work. It's hard to go into Cook County, Illinois and say, come work on a farm. With difficulties finding domestic workers, White said that many rural communities, farms, and meat processing facilities look overseas to meet ag labor needs. Iowa State University's Ann Johans, program specialist and editor of ISU's Ag Decision Maker, said that farmers have to find the right person for the job in a tough environment to find hired help. I think it's always a tight labor market. Finding people who have the skills to match the job, she said. Joanne said some farmers might be looking to hire manual labor or would rather outsource specialized tasks such as herbicide spraying or more office-based business tasks such as house bookkeeping or taxes. Retention takes creativity, communication. Beyond finding good employees for the farm, retaining them is equally important, given the time and cost of finding and training new workers. You have to take a look at who you're competing with and what they have to offer, Milholland said. He said that farmers can look to different incentives to keep good workers around. This could mean some flexible hours, especially during less busy times of the year on the farm. It could also be bonuses and performance-based incentives or even frozen beef or help with housing arrangements. Charges filed in fatal arson fire near Long Creek, by Tony Reed. A man from Mount Zion and a Decatur woman have been charged with aggravated arson and the concealment of a homicidal death after the body of a woman was found at the scene of a blaze near Long Creek. Michael D. Wicker, Jr., 43, and 36-year-old Kelly J. Lewis are being held in the Macon County Jail in connection with the death of Stephanie Crone of Decatur. The 55-year-old victim's body was found Sunday morning in a barn on the 8,000 block of Ridge Road, which runs east of Decatur Airport by Long Creek. Firefighters who were called to deal with a blaze in that location. Macon County jail records show both suspects were booked into custody one after the other, Wicker at 6:48 p.m. Monday and Lewis at 6:55 p.m. Wicker is also charged with violation of parole, possession of methamphetamine, and felon in possession of a firearm. A check of his record with the Illinois Department of Correction shows he was sentenced to 26 years in January of 2014 in Christian County after being convicted of armed robbery. Court records also showed he was sentenced to an additional 21 years for a second conviction of armed robbery with a firearm, although the two sentences were ordered to be served concurrently. Wicker was paroled on January 18, 2024 from the Graham Correctional Center. Lewis was also charged with violation of a parole and felon in possession of a firearm. A check of her court record reveals that she was sentenced in Macon County Circuit Court to 4 years in prison in April of 2023 after being convicted of her third aggravated driving under the influence offense. She was also sentenced to an additional 3 years after being convicted of possession of meth, although the sentences were ordered to run concurrently. She had earlier been part of the hybrid court program for DUI drivers but flunked out of it after the court accused her of not complying with the requirements of the treatment program. Lewis was paroled on September 13, 2024, from the Decatur Correctional Center. Child Sex Abuse Sentencing Setback by Tony Reed. Decatur, given there was a last-minute switch in defense lawyers, a judge Monday said he would reluctantly agree to push back the sentencing date for a married Decatur couple convicted of possessing images of child sexual abuse. But Macon County Circuit Court Judge Lindsay Shelton said she was only willing to postpone the sentencing of Douglas Nichols and Kelly Nichols to May 19th from its original set date of April 24th. When the new defense lawyer, Robert Robertson, who only officially took over the case April 4th after the couple fired their previous attorneys, asked if he could delay the sentencing until early June, the judge's one-word answer was no. Sheldon, speaking at a status hearing on the couple's cases, did, however, find that Robertson was working hard to get up to speed as he plows through an ocean of evidence and copious files plus a detailed bench trial transcript. The Chicago-based lawyer who appeared via Zoom conference call also needs time to come down to the Decatur Police Department to view the actual images that formed the evidence in the couple's October bench trial. The court is concerned that he has not had the chance to review the images that were presented at trial, Sheldon said. That is obviously an issue for the sentencing hearing in the court's view. So I'm going to reluctantly grant a motion to continue the sentencing hearing since there are still necessary things that need to get accomplished. I do want to set this fairly quickly, though, if possible. I do not want to string this out, as I made clear on the last court date. Both the defendants were convicted of 10 counts of each of possession of images of child sexual abuse involving members of their family. Kelly Nichols, 54, also was found guilty of recording a pornographic video of a girl under the age of 13, a Class X felony. That means she is facing mandatory prison time, unlike her 56-year-old husband, who could get probation. Robertson is also hoping to partner with another experienced Chicago trial lawyer, Mike Leonard, to help him wade through the evidence. But given the short amount of time and an already busy trial schedule for Leonard, who also took part in the Zoom call, it's not clear how much help he can offer. Robertson, meanwhile, told the judge he was prioritizing the case above his other legal work and laboring hard to present a solid plea for looking at the couples leniently when it comes time to sentence them. The attorney also told the judge there was no shortage of people in the Decatur community willing to speak up on the Nichols' behalf. He said he has received 62 letters written in defense of the couple's character. "I've never actually had clients who've given me 62 mitigation letters," he said. "Usually it's hard to get 5 or 10. I want to talk to each one of these people and see who would best reflect to this court the true nature of Kelly and Doug Nichols. This headline reads, Probation for Man Who Beat His Cousin by Tony Reed. Nichols W. Matherly has been sentenced to 24 months on probation after a bowling alley argument that led to him beating his cousin to the point where the victim suffered a brain bleed, according to police reports. A sworn affidavit said patrol officers who came to the scene could immediately tell there was something badly wrong with a 34-year-old victim who was having trouble remembering what just happened. Later at Decatur Memorial Hospital, he suffered a seizure and was transferred to Springfield Memorial Hospital for emergency treatment. Matherly's case had been scheduled for a jury trial April 8th, but the 30-year-old Decatur man appeared at Macon County Circuit Court on April 4th and said he was ready to make a plea deal. He then admitted to a charge of aggravated battery causing great bodily harm, while Judge Jeffrey Geisler agreed to transmit further charges of aggravated battery and aggravated domestic battery. Decatur Police Department officer Jacob Stewart, who signed the affidavit, said the trouble broke out on the night of November 23rd at the Spare Time Lanes. Stewart said the violence was captured on surveillance video and police were able to see exactly what had happened. The cousin had been in a verbal dispute with Matherly, who then punches the victim and grabs him in a headlock before throwing him into a chair at a table. Stewart said both men were then ordered to leave by the bowling alley staff and were gathering their gear when another verbal confrontation took place. Matherly then strikes the victim three times in the face and head with a closed fist. These blows caused the victim to fall to the floor, striking the back of his head, the officer added. In addition to the probation sentence, Geisler ordered Matherly to pay $250 to have his DNA added to a criminal database maintained by the state police. And this headline under national news, Trump turns to instinct. After President Donald Trump reversed course on his tariffs and announced he would pursue trade negotiations, he had a simple explanation for how he would make decisions in the coming weeks. Instinctively, more than anything else, he told reporters, you almost can't take a pencil to paper. It's really more of an instinct than anything else. It was the latest example of how Trump loves to keep everyone on edge for his next move. Trump has not only expansively flexed the powers of the presidency by declaring emergencies and shredding political norms, he has eschewed traditional deliberative procedures for making decisions. The result is that more of life around the country and the world is subject to the president's desires than ever before. We have a democratic leader who seems to have the authority to act as whimsically as a 19th century European autocrat, said Sim Naftali, a historian and senior research scholar at Columbia University. He sneezes and everyone catches a cold. The White House rejects criticism that Trump is overstepping his authority or improperly consolidating power. Administration officials frequently emphasize that the Republican president won a clear election victory and is now pursuing the agenda that he campaigned on. In this view, resisting his will, such as when courts block his executive orders, is the real threat to democracy. Trust in President Trump, White House President Secretary Caroline Leavitt said Friday, while answering questions about economic policy. He knows what he's doing. The presidency has been accumulating powers for years, long before Trump came to office, and it is not unusual for administrations to veer in various directions based on political and policy priorities. But Trump's new term has been different in early months, and he seems to recognize it. The second term is just more powerful, Trump marveled recently. When I say do it, they do it. Although international trade offers the most extensive example of Trump's inclination to act unilaterally, since he returned to office in January, the same approach has been evident elsewhere. He installed himself as chair of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts to overhaul programming at Washington's premier cultural institution. He issued an order to purge improper ideology from the Smithsonian Institution's network of museums. He punished law firms associated with his opponents. He directed the Justice Department to investigate former officials who crossed him during his first term. When Trump decided to remove regulations on household water efficiency, he wants more water flowing in showers, his executive order said the normal public comment period is unnecessary because I am ordering the repeal. And I'm going to have to stop this right here, but I will finish up the article in the second half, which will be back in about 2 minutes.